I remember thinking about how terrified she must have been. She died, and then felt fear or pain no longer. Then I thought about her mother. The mother had to hear her daughter's screams and feel her pain and her fear every day for the rest of her life. I had taken some risks at that point that could have ended badly, and was contemplating that I might take others. And I never wanted my mother to endure such grief. So I marched into the kitchen where she was washing dishes and without preamble said, "I want you to know that no matter what happens to me, I will not die in fear." My mother stopped washing the dishes. "What?" "If something bad happens to me," I continued, "I don't want you to go through life thinking that I die in terror. It will be okay. I will not die in fear." She looked at me a bit strangely, said, "Thank you," and returned to her washing. My mother was implacable. That said, I began to wonder if I could actually be able to keep that promise if events warranted it. I've been in some fairly hairy situations, and I've managed to control my fear, but of course, I can never be certain of what I would do if the circumstances were really terrible. However, I have come to believe that although there is much that we cannot control, with practice we can learn to live a life without fear of the future, certainly, and a better chance of controlling our fear when danger is present. Looking back on my life, I realize that I began my practice of controlling fear without that being a goal at all. As a child, I began to have a series of hero dreams, which had the incoherence of all dreams, but also the dramatic quality of a blockbuster movie. I was in elementary school in the 1950s, the height of the Cold War, another period of time, by the way, in which fear permeated our society with ill effect. It was a time when we stocked our underground shelters with canned goods, practiced hiding under our wooden desks at school as protection against nuclear bombs, an irrational response to an irrational fear, if there ever was one, and warned that when the commies invaded, as they surely would, they would brainwash us and turn us against our parents. So in my dreams, the enemy was always the Russians who had invaded my hometown. In every episode, I led a small band of insurgents who outfought and outwitted these invaders of my land. If this sounds familiar to any of you, it's because someone stole my dream and turned it into a movie called Red Dawn, with Patrick Swayze playing my part. In the movie, the invaders were Chinese rather than Russian, and in some of my avoid suing for copyright infringement. At some point, these hero dreams became integrated with flying dreams. I was fighting the same enemy, but I had added flight to my personal. In many of these dreams, knowing that I could fly, I would find myself at the edge of a precipice with the enemy bearing down behind me and unable to call upon my superpower no matter how hard I tried. These dreams were so real that I would wake up in a panic, sweating, my heart pounding. But over time, having the same dream over again, I learned that if I did not panic, but focused without fear on what I had to do, I could regain my flying capabilities and escape the horrors. Through these dreams, I had the opportunity to practice experiencing danger and coming to terms with it. I learned that fear was not useful. In fact, it was downright dangerous because it blocked my ability to think through a crisis and do what needed to be done. In my mid-teens, I began reading Holocaust literature, starting with The Diary of Anne Frank, Mile 18, Exodus, and others. I still had hero dreams, but they took on a darker turn. I now put myself in the position of a Holocaust victim and explored what I would do and feel under similar circumstances. The dreams became more sophisticated. There were now ethical dilemmas to consider. Would I save myself at the expense of others? Would I sacrifice myself to save others? Would I choose to fight or submit when I was likely to die in either case? How would my decision affect others? These were complicated dreams, although I will tell you I was still outwitting and I was fighting the enemy most of the time. I never actually died in these dreams. I don't think it's actually possible to die in dreams, who would tell the story? However, there were times when the dreams ended at a potentially fatal moment without my final resolution. I was coming to terms with the fact that sometimes even heroes die. Over time, I grew comfortable with that notion. I still fought with every tool I had in my hero dreams, but I was not afraid of death if that was to be the outcome. These dreams ceased for the most part in my late teens or early 20s, but they resurfaced again at various stages of my children's lives. These, of course, were the hardest ones of all, because now the object was to protect the lives of my children. And again, the backdrop was usually the Holocaust. It took years before I was able to resign myself to the fact that I could not ultimately protect my children. I could provide the tools to help them survive, including moral fiber. I could tell them I loved them forever. I could help them not fear death, but I could not guarantee their safety. Once you are able to accept the fact that your children could die and you could do nothing about it, conquering every other fear is a piece of cake. I used to think that everyone had hero dreams, but then the many confident people with whom I am surrounded are as confident as they appear. But I no longer think that's true. I am shocked at the number of people who have never contemplated their own death because they are so afraid of it. And if you are afraid of death, you are also afraid of everything that could lead to death. And that is almost everything. Hero dreams are not the only way to learn to control fear. As a junior in college, I took a snorkeling class. The final exam was to swim 10 laps of this ancient chlorine-laden pool with just a snorkel, no mask, and without panicking. The first time I tried it, I found myself in churning water, kicked by fellow students in front of me and pushed from behind, unable to see a thing and getting water up my nose. Long before I finished the first lap, I came up coughing and choking. We had one more opportunity to pass the exam. In the intervening week, I practiced holding my nose so that I was more comfortable breathing through my mouth. But more importantly, I used visual imaging to control my breathing and focus on the task rather than the chaos surrounding me. It took more self-control than I have ever needed before or since, but I managed to swim those 10 laps without panicking and bolting to the surface. Mental imaging is a more focused way of dreaming when you are awake, and it's a great tool. There are successful treatments for true phobias, but other fears may be conquered by looking them square at the face and deciding not to succumb. When my children were young, we lived in a neighborhood full of kids. My oldest son was skinny and something of a nerd, a perfect target for bullies. I would watch him walk to the bus in the morning with his head down, literally flinching when anyone passed him. In a couple of occasions, he came home crying that someone had called him names and pushed him. In desperation, I finally said, "You know, that sidewalk and the sky above it belongs as much to you as it belongs to anyone else. They have no more right to use it than you do." He looked at me as though this were a new concept. "When you walk down the street," I continued, "keep your head up as though you belong there. Look square at the other kids, smile, and say hello." He looked dubious. "How will that help?" "Trust me," I said with more resolve than I felt. "It will work." The next morning, I watched him march down the sidewalk, held head high, waving and saying hello to the other kids and mingling without incident with the others at the bus stop. I have to say, I was absolutely flabbergasted. Fear is not an effective defense against danger, but maybe confidence can be. People who have suffered abuse, like the woman in Frost's poem, struggle with debilitating fear long after they have been able to sever the official relationship with their abuser. It is incredibly difficult, but it is possible to do so. I first knew one of my divorce clients as a young woman in my office, literally shaking with fear. Although she was attractive and intelligent, she'd been convinced that she was worthless and powerless against her abusive physician husband. Even after the divorce was granted, like the woman in Frost's poem, she saw her ex-husband in every shadow, behind every tree, long after he was of any danger to her. But she fought back against her fear. She named her fear. She examined it. She began to distinguish reality from myth, or her perception. It took her more than 4 years of hard work, but today she deals with her ex-husband, who's the father of her child, with poise and even a sense of humor, knowing that she holds more cards in her hand than he holds in his. She is an accomplished professional, has married a man who treats her as she deserves to be treated, and a couple of years ago gave birth to her second child, a long-time dream. She smiles a lot. Living without fear has transformed her life. Focusing on gratitude for what we have rather than dwelling on the endless potential for disaster is another way to practice freedom from fear. My children accuse me of being in a state of denial when I refuse to be sufficiently concerned about the state of the world. What is the bad state of the world? I'm concerned about the state of the world, but not what is the bad part. But it is not necessary to ignore the reality of dangers, both large and small, to live without fear. I know, with a touch of humor I have to say, that someday our entire planet is going to explode, no matter what we do or don't do. And climate change does exist, and that and other forces that come to bear may well result in some cataclysmic changes, although I have no idea what, when, how, or where that will happen. But we have survived as a race some species, some tragedies before. In the Middle Ages, 75 to 200 million people, 30 to 60% of Europe's total population, succumbed to bubonic plague. During World War II, 80 million people died. Just 10 years ago, approximately 230,000 men, women, and children were swept away in a tsunami. For the most part, these cataclysmic events, if not forgotten, have receded in our memories. Interesting that the death of just 3,000 people more than 10 years ago continues to scare us and dictate our foreign policy. What is that? The bottom line is that individuals, we are all going to die in the not too distant future. If we live the one brief life allotted to us, in fear of all the potential ways our lives could end, instead of taking advantage of all the wonderful ways to enjoy our lives, we squander that one great gift. We have little enough control over who we are or what happens to us. More than we advocates of free will would like to admit, genetics and upbringing limit our choices. But I am convinced that fear is something we can control, at least in part. By becoming comfortable with our own mortality, practicing through dreams or mental imaging or however how to handle difficult situations, learning to realistically assess the dangers of the world we live in without letting them overwhelm us, we can all learn to look forward to each coming day, not with the dread of its potential threats, but with anticipation of its promise of joy. For many years, I never knew whether my mother had really heard or understood what I was trying to tell her in that kitchen so long ago. But when she was in her mid-80s, she planned a trip to Myanmar, where my great-grandfather had been a missionary. It was to include an elephant trek through the jungle, and my father, already in the mid-stage of Alzheimer's, was to be included. My brothers and I asked my mother repeatedly to reconsider the wisdom of taking this dangerous trip. Finally, she turned to me, looked me square in the eye, smiled, and said, "Don't worry, I won't die afraid."
more contemplation towards your response time.